You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
So we come to an understanding of what is taking place. We are consciousness. Quantum measurement produces a split, subject-object split, but this subject is still universal. It is what I call the quantum self. And here we have creativity, we have discontinuity, we have non-locality, which is expressed by Carl Jung's beautiful term, synchronicity. Here we are holistic, we are the whole. Whole of consciousness is not lost. The immediacy of experience carries this. We have non-locality, and we are transpersonal. To be contrasted with the very conditioned ego, which then has developed a necessary characteristic because it's linear, it's algorithmic, it can reason. So reasoning has become a characteristic instead of creativity, intuitive characteristic. Continuous instead of discontinuous, determined instead of synchronistic, determined by past cause, linear, local, and personal. Both are identities of consciousness. Consciousness first identifies with the universal consciousness and in this immediacy of experience. But when we are not in that immediacy of experience, when we allow the experience to be siphoned through the mirror of memory, when we allow our experience to be reflexive, reflections in the mirror of memory causes the egoic pattern of looking at things. And then we are identifying with those personal habits. Neither of these are our true identities. We are consciousness, the whole. But the ego is even more false than the quantum self-identity. Quantum self-identity has an immediacy. It's a necessity of manifestation. If we have to see ourselves subject as opposed to object, then there is no way but to go through quantum self. But there is no reason for us to identify with the ego self. This then starts what is called spirituality. Why spirituality? Because it is possible to go from the ego self identity to the quantum self identity. It is possible to penetrate the veil of continuity that past experiences impose upon us. Next one, please. Now I will very quickly go through some of the scientific consequences of using quantum physics to introduce consciousness in our science. And this is very important. I think we have a new science within the primacy of consciousness only if we can use this way of thinking in deciphering some of the problems that plague us, some of the problems that we have been discovering in other fields. Now, in psychology, very importantly, a great discovery happened towards the end of the 60s and early 70s. This is called transpersonal psychology. Abraham Maslow and others were the forces behind this, Carl Jung. What happened was, particularly Maslow's data is striking. Now, ordinarily, when we think of conscious beings, we talk about mental health. That's the health of the inner experience that people have. If we can cope with the world, we call ourselves mentally healthy. And if we cannot cope with the world very well, the relationships and everything, then we call ourselves mentally pathological. Now, these two categories have been known for quite some time. Freud particularly contributed greatly to this, and behaviorism. But Maslow found in his research that there is a third category, a small one, maybe 10% of all people, maybe even less. But it is definitely a finite fraction of people who are more than just mentally healthy. They're more than just coping with experiences. What are they doing? Maslow found that they're creative. Maslow found that they're environmentally independent. They're capable of unconditional love, and so forth. In particular, Maslow found that they are happy. Now, this is very important. I want to emphasize this. See, if you went to India and you asked a person, what is consciousness? One of the Indian gurus or teachers. He would say consciousness is Sat, Chit, Ananda. These are Sanskrit words, so I have to translate. Sat means existence. That's easy. We all know that we exist. That one nobody has to define for us. Chit is awareness. That one also is automatic. We have subject-object experience. Nobody has to tell us that we have chit. The third one, ananda, which is often translated as bliss or spiritual joy, the third one is the key. Third one is the key. Here is Maslow's point. And here is the point that the Hindus of India are also trying to make, because they discovered it directly. We have a varying degree of joy in our life. Some of us are just not very happy. And it does not depend on the wealth we have. It does not depend on the material position we have. It does not depend on the amount of fame we have. What does it depend on? It depends on no thing or nothing. This is what Maslow discovered, that some people have somehow tapped into the source of happiness. And this then defines the spiritual journey once again. Because this must be our natural state. This must be our natural state. There's a story in the Upanishad which illustrates this beautifully. A person is sleeping in the forest. Another person comes along, who is obviously a doer, and says, what are you doing? Namely, what are you doing lazying? What are you doing? Why aren't you working? So the person who is sleeping or trying to sleep says, why should I work? Well, then you can maybe build a house for yourself. What should I do with the house? Well, you can buy furniture and furnish the house. Chairs, sofas, and all that. What should I do with furniture, sofas? Well, you can sit down on one and relax. But of course the guy says, but I'm already relaxing. Why do all that? Relaxing is natural state. Happiness is natural state. I'm already happy. I don't need to do anything. So Maslow discovered that these people, this 10% of all population in his sample, they have discovered the source of happiness. This, I insist, is the key. Okay? I'll come back to this again later. Next one, please. Now, the great development that this science has enabled us to is the solution of some very knotty problems of biology. Biologists have a hard time defining life. This you already know. I don't know how many biologists are there in this audience, but you just had a biology conference in Los Angeles area. I wish I were there, because this is very, very important. Now, it is true that there is one biologist, at least in Chile, Humberto Maturana, who defines life exactly the way that quantum physics enables us to define life. Maturana says that only ultimately defining solution to life, one that can solve the riddle of what is the difference between life and non-life. Materialist scientists cannot really make any difference between life and non-life. To them, it's just a continuum. Maturana says the defining difference is that in life, there always is cognition. There is a recognition from a living thing, a living object, as itself being separate from the environment. Cognition. Quantum physics allows us to see this automatically. Suppose you define living cell is the first object in terms of material evolution where a quantum measurement can take place. Quantum measurement in that self-preferential schema that I described before. Same thing that happens in the brain in the most uncomplicated way can happen in a single living cell. So the subject-object split then is a result of quantum measurement in the living cell. Quantum measurement does not happen in a non-living object. This then differentiates the living and the non-living. See, if we differentiate them this way, what can you say about life? Can you say something very concrete? Yes. There is a big problem in living objects. Next one, please. Big problem is evolution. Evolution of life has been known to take place in spurts. In spurts. In addition to Darwinian continuous evolution. The spurts are called punctuation mark, as in continuous prose. Darwinian evolution is like continuous prose, but there exist punctuation marks. Next one, please. This is called the theory of punctuated equilibrium by Stephen Gould and Niles Elrich. There are two tempos of biological evolution. Now, biologists have been aware of this for 25 years. What happened was that the mechanism for this fast tempo. Fast tempo, by the way, the experimental proof of that is that fossil record lacks for speciation, change of one species into another. For example, there is no fossil record how the last reptile became the first bird. There is no fossil record of that, the continuous record of how the wings developed. So, punctuated equilibrium, the idea is that if this evolution from one species to another is very rapid, then there is no time to lay fossils. So fossil record would be lacking. Very simple idea. But the explanations sought by biologists are all based on contingency. Something happened, geographical isolation. Something happened, some meteors falling. Geographical catastrophe. That kind of contingency is the only way they could understand how something could discontinuously affect evolution. Quantum physics has another answer, a better answer. Because if you look at what the problem is of explaining speciation in Darwinian theory, you get a very good clue. What is difficult in Darwinian theory, and let me refresh your memory, Darwinian theory says that there is variation, and then there is selection from it. The variation is caused by mutation of the genetic material, and then natural selection, nature selects among this variation. So part of evolution is chance, mutation, and part of evolution is Darwinian natural selection, necessity for survival. So this chance and necessity mechanism is what Darwinism propagates for biological evolution. What is the difficulty in this? If you look at one species and then look at another species, you find that the changes, the mutations necessary for making a transition from one species to another are many. Take the case of a species without eye and species with eye. Eye is such a complex mechanism, it literally takes thousands and thousands of mutations. But Darwinism says that every mutation has to be selected for or against, because nature will always select among them. But individual mutation, 1/1000th of an eye, is no good. So it must be selectively rooted out. It cannot be present in a subsequent generation because it has no selective advantage. This is what time is Darwinism, and people seek vainly to find very artificial answers. Quantum physics has a wonderful answer, because in quantum physics, the mutations are not things. They're only possibilities. Untreated consciousness has chosen from among these possibilities, right? So this is the key. Biological evolution can happen because thousands of mutations in possibility occurs until consciousness sees a pattern. Next one, please. Consciousness recognizes the pattern, and the pattern, this too, is not a coincidence. Rupert Sheldrake, a biologist, has been talking about such patterns, he calls them morphogenetic fields, for some time in biology. It's very radical thinking in biology, but very useful for quantum physics to recognize it. Because these patterns then, when a pattern is fulfilled, when a pattern is complete, then consciousness can collapse it. But the species initiates it. Species initiates it from survival necessity. Now this idea that species initiating its own evolution has been directly verified in the laboratory. It's called the phenomenon of directed mutation. Bacteria, E. coli, feeds on lactose, but only a certain kind of lactose. A mutated bacteria with one mutation can handle another kind of lactose. So when researchers proffered E. coli with the second kind of lactose, then of course the E. coli, normal E. coli, would starve and die. So what was found is that they didn't die. What happened? The E. coli directed its own mutation, changed the mutation rate by a tremendous degree, so that they could survive the change of food. This is astounding experimental data in favor of something in addition to Darwinism is needed. Something that can only be understood as consciousness intervening in biological evolution. So literally, the evidence is now showing that there doesn't need to be a battle between creationism and evolutionism. Both sides have to give a little. Creationism have to give up the idea that God created the world in 6 days, and 6 days is not a metaphor. But if we take the majority of Christian theologians who have long recognized that the 6 days is just a metaphor, then the idea of God's intervention in the biological world of evolution is easily seen to be revived in the quantum way of looking at things. Yes, consciousness intervenes in crucial points, these punctuation marks. That's the doings of consciousness. That's how purposiveness enters. Consciousness, yes, consciousness does have purposiveness in terms of these morphogenetic patterns, fields. And consciousness uses this purposiveness to guide evolution. Of course, adequate recognition can be given to contingencies. Adequate recognition can be given to Darwinism, which then helps the individual species to adapt to the changes in environment. So all of biology can be fit in this new quantum theory. Next one, please. Now, one objection to Sheldrake's morphogenetic fields is that it smacks of vitalism. Are we reintroducing non-local morphogenetic fields, non-material fields, which is like a vital body? Yes, we are. But the assumption of vital body is repugnant only when you have old form of dualism, that the vital body, being non-material, cannot interact with the physical, which is material. What mediates the interaction? The best aspect of this consciousness-based science is that we now clearly see that there is a mediator. Consciousness mediates the interaction. So vital body, mind, intellect, all these different experiences in our various compartments in consciousness, they are all possibilities, as matter is possibility. These possibilities exist in consciousness. Consciousness, when it collapses an experience, collapses all these possibilities. And then they become actualized in our experience. When we look at the vital body this way, then there is no dualism problem. Not only that, when we look at ourselves this way, that mind is like this also. Thoughts are objects of possibility as well. When you look at thoughts this way, then another riddle becomes very clear. A riddle that is coming to fore from the work of healers, from the work of alternative medicine. And there are tremendous breakthrough. I'll just mention two names, Larry Doocy and Deepak Chopra. Tremendous breakthrough has happened because Larry Doocy has emphasized, and Randolph Bird has verified, that quantum non-locality plays an enormous role in healing. In Bird's experiment, many of you know this because this was done in San Francisco, people were prayed for at a distance. double-blind experiment. The prayers didn't know about the prayers, only a list. And they prayed anyway, from a distance, without knowing who they are praying for, just the names. Just that intention, non-local intention, enhanced the recovery rate of these patients in a hospital in San Francisco. This is a great experiment which now has been replicated in many places. Deepak Chopra has been studying similarly discontinuity in healing. Just as there is discontinuity in evolution, he found that there is discontinuity in mind's ability to heal such disease as cancer. Overnight, tumors seem to vanish when the proper creativity is aroused in the patient. So again, this is an example of quantum healing. But the problem is, when you pose it in a dualistic way, it seems impossible. Mind is expressed in us as thoughts. Thoughts, if you look upon them as brain phenomena, obviously has very, very little energy. So the criticism is that how can a thought which has so little energy can lead to the emission of a neurochemical or a neuropeptide which will then communicate with the immune system and start the healing process? How can that be? Because a neurochemical requires a lot of energy. So how can it be? Well, it can be if you take the model of psychophysical parallelism seriously. Next one, please. So how does mind-body healing occur? Brain possibilities, as well as possibilities of the psyche, all exist in consciousness. Consciousness sees a confluence, a healing thought, and simultaneously then collapses a state of the brain, which includes the emission of the suitable neuropeptide that then will initiate the connection of the brain with the immune system. As simple as that. There is no energy involved, there is no energetic exchange between the thought and the brain, consciousness collapsing independently, the brain and the mind, to mediate the interaction necessary for healing. Surprisingly, Deepak Chopra, in his book Quantum Healing, substantially was able to intuit power of creativity once again, able to intuit this basic picture. I'm just giving more flesh on his ideas. Next one, please. So, this is a sculpture by Salvador Dali, but it's very reflective of our time. You know, the humanities, the arts, music, all these fields, spirituality, all these aspects of humanity have always recognized the role of consciousness. That really human endeavor is nothing but a search for our soul, to use Carl Jung's language. We are engaged in the search for the soul. Science has been the one exception. Science has insisted that no, we are engaged only in the search of elementary particles, from meaning to non-meaning. Finally, that is changing. So I present to you this picture where this science is represented as this metallic creature and posited as a male. It's a very apt metaphor. I hope the male members of the audience will forgive me, but I think we see our ineptness in this thing, because we are very intellectual, as you know. But this is the thing. Look at this very frozen male creature. Look at what's happening to him. Even his head is a little sprouting. Even his head has a little sprouting. This is the thing. So science is thawing with the help of quantum physics. There is a definite sprouting of creativity. It's a definite sprouting of consciousness. Science is joining the search for the soul. And this is very good news, this integration. So next question that I'll tackle is the question of how do we then do it? How do we discover consciousness for ourselves? You know, you have heard various models of consciousness. People still make very material models of consciousness, rightfully so, because many people believe that it has to be that way. How can it be any other way? Because for them, it's all elementary particles. They cannot accept that there is something that science is not going to be able to answer, which quantum physics accepts. quantum physics accepts discontinuity. Beyond the discontinuity, quantum physics agrees that physics stops. Uncertainty principle was basic in quantum physics. So if you are a true quantum physicist, you have no problem in accepting the fact that consciousness exists as a prime mover. And we cannot explain consciousness with an equation, with a model. Consciousness is not an object. But then how do we discover what consciousness is directly? Part of it is experimental metaphysics, to use Shimoni's beautiful phrase. Part of it we certainly have verified already, non-locality of consciousness in Greenberg's experiment, downward causation in Helmut Schmidt's experiment, and there will be more to come. Part of the non-locality of consciousness is also parapsychological phenomena, and there is more to come. But these phenomena, this experimental metaphysics, as helpful as they are, can never ultimately convince us the wholeness, the transcendent aspect of consciousness. There we are on our own. We have to find the journey towards this wholeness. In other words, we have to do it ourselves. Now, here is then the big pitch. And coming from ions, it's not surprising, because as you know, the soul of ions was a man named Willis Herman, and this was his basic teaching, that scientists of consciousness must be completely devoted to transformation. Consciousness, in Willis's view, cannot be studied without a journey of transformation on the part of anyone. If you want to really know consciousness, you have to transform yourself. Transform yourself to what? To consciousness. So let's see how this journey goes. There is a reward of this journey, because as we become more conscious, we also become more happy, as Abraham Maslow discovered independently. Next one, please. So how do we get from this cogito ergo sum, this thinking mind? This is the problem. How do we go beyond this thinking mind? So the first thing that comes to mind is that maybe we'll just meditate. Meditate the thinking mind away. Next one, please. I cannot resist this cartoon. Because a corollary of Descartes' thinking is that if I think not, then I am not. Unfortunately, it's not that simple. There is a story about the Chinese Zen patriarch Huineng, who once saw a disciple meditating, and he started making a ruckus, picking up two stones and rubbing them together. So the disciple opens his eyes, sees Huineng doing this crazy thing, and says, "What are you doing?" And Huineng says, "I'm trying to make a mirror." So the disciple gets livid with anger, says, "You cannot make a mirror by rubbing two stones together." And Huineng says, "And you think you can be enlightened by meditating?" So what can we do? Next one, please. Well, it is a journey of creativity. Spirituality, I submit, is nothing but inner creativity. It's creativity directed to inward exploration. The idea is to discover newer and newer context of living that will enable us to choose happiness over unhappiness, enable us to choose what Maslow called positive mental health. This is really the scheme. Why creativity? Because remember, creativity is a function of the quantum self, where we are one, where we are happy. So creativity is fundamentally a gift of being. In this being, we have identity with the object that we are discovering. When you discover things this way, then we can live what we discover. In other words, creative experiences come with certainty. There is a story about Einstein, who discovered the theory of general relativity, the theory of gravity, as you may know. It took 4 years for experimentalists to verify this theory, and when it was verified, telegrams poured in. So a newswoman, the following day, saw Einstein sitting at his desk with all these telegrams, and she asked, "Professor Einstein, it's very nice that your theory was verified, but how would you have felt if your theory was proven wrong?" And Einstein said, "I would have felt sorry for the dear Lord." "My theory," he said, "is correct." Now, is this the voice of a very proud, non-humble man? Hardly. He was just expressing his certainty. And creative discoveries, and many of you have such discoveries in arts, in music, in sciences, in culture, you know that when that insight comes, you are completely certain about it. It's no uncertainty there, because it comes from being. So that's why creativity is ultimately very important. It is also the answer why people cannot change by continuous efforts, why spiritual efforts, spiritual practices, ultimately are not the only thing that leads to transformation. Now, in spiritual traditions, this is acknowledged, but acknowledged in a garb that is not very readily understood. Acknowledged under such phrases as the grace of God, divine grace. That's the non-algorithmic part. That's the part where you cannot do anything. You just have to wait. And wait for what? For the quantum leap to take place. So in this way, spiritual transformation is a matter of inner creativity. Next one, please. Now, I have written a book on this subject, Quantum Creativity, which you might like to look at for a more detailed exposition of all this. Next one, please. So the creative process. This is very important, because creativity is a very well-studied phenomenon. It's really one of the phenomena that we have studied and we can be proud of in the last 75 years or so. We really know how creativity functions. We really know a lot about creativity. And the studies show that it is indeed a very quantum process. It has four stages, roughly speaking: preparation, incubation or unconscious processing, sudden insight, and manifestation. Of this, preparation is fairly obvious, you know, reading up on what is known, etc. And manifestation is fairly obvious, trying to manifest the insight into the particular language that is going to express the insight. But the middle two, the quantum nature, is very, very clear. What is unconscious processing? Processing without awareness. This is the processing without subject-object split. This is the processing when consciousness is one with the possibilities. What is so hard to do unconscious processing? Because it's non-doing. Because it does not involve any doing at all. All doing is subject-object split awareness. And it is very hard because we live in a do-do-do world. So sometimes I say in my workshops that instead of do-do-do, accept Frank Sinatra, do-be-do-be-do. Then we could. But this is part of Zen teaching also. You all know the beautiful lines, sitting quietly doing nothing, the spring comes, the grass grows by itself. So that's non-doing, and that has to be combined. And then this preparation and incubation, alternatively, do and be. Then sudden insight can happen. It also encompasses one further item of interest. This also has been discovered in creativity research itself, an old mystical idea and process. And this I must share with you. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi has coined a beautiful phrase called the flow experience. In quantum terms, the flow experience is as far as we can go in terms of practicing. What does the flow experience mean? It means an encounter, using Rollo May's term, between the ego and the quantum self encounter. Now, if you remember a previous picture, the reflection in the mirror of memory takes place in several steps. Neurophysiologists have measured how long it takes. It's about half a second. So the idea is to penetrate this half a second, what psychologists call preconscious. Idea is to penetrate that, and when you do that, then our sense of time changes. Time slows down, so to speak. The way we see things change, things become much more spontaneous. And this is what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi is calling flow experience. It's an enormously beautiful experience. In fact, Patanjali, the great exponent of yoga who lived in 1st century AD, called this dhyana. Buddhists have names for it, jhana meditations. But whatever name you call it, it is this flow experience that is the real practice, spiritual practice that you can do. And you can also live in this way of a flow. Then it has very spiritual names. In Christianity, there was a great mystic named Brother Lawrence who called this practicing the presence of God. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's called Dzogchen. It's a beautiful, beautiful practice of just practicing presence. So what is it like? I'll give you another rendition by Michelangelo of this flow experience. In flow experience, we're touching the quantum self, also known as God. So it's reaching out to God, Adam reaching out to God, the ego reaching out to quantum self. Can we live this way? What does it entail? This is what we have to do, really. This is what we can do in order to know consciousness. How to know consciousness? How to know God? How to know being? We have to ultimately recognize that we cannot do anything to do just that, because it's ultimately grace, quantum leap, discontinuity. But we can reach out. We cannot touch. If you look at the picture, the fingers are not exactly touching. Michelangelo was so perceptive about this process because he knew. The touch requires quantum leap, but we can be close. We can start dancing with it. And dancing is an apt metaphor, because in dancing, we most easily reach this encounter with the quantum self. So the final rendition of the quantum physicist for you to know consciousness is to just say, like the author of Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll, said, will you, won't you join the dance? Because there is nothing but this dance that is going on. With our ego, we create all kinds of things about consciousness, all kinds of falsity that just creates barriers. And this part of this falsity is to not recognize the eastern half of the hemisphere and think that we today can discover consciousness without recognizing all the heritage. It's like Einstein discovering relativity without the help of Newton. We don't have to do that. Let's recognize the mystical heritage, recognize that these people are really talking about solid data, the Buddhas and the Jesuses. There are so many of them in all cultures. They have already shown us, and we are now confirming with quantum physics everything that they have told us. We can take these lessons, verify it for ourselves, that really works. We have the theory. All we have to do is to start dancing. Then, thank you.
Beautiful.